As promised on last week's program, we are going to devote half of today's show to a probing look at the election and Donald J. Trump and what the hell's going on with our favorite political correspondent, Stephen J. Harper. He's been the creator of the Insurrection Timeline, the Pandemic Timeline series, and the Trump-Russia-Ukraine Timeline, found at BillMoyers.com. He's an author, he's an adjunct professor of law, and he knows more about Trump than just about anybody we know and has been happy to talk to us about it, and we're happy to have him back. So my privilege to say welcome back to Radio Parallax, Stephen J. Harper.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
You wrote a piece for Common Dreams on the 28th of September titled, How Trump is Already Trying to Rig the 2024 Election, and you then talked about what's likely to happen in the courts. Let's discuss this.
Probably the easiest place to start is where people are not even focused, which is that when you vote, you're actually not voting for a candidate. You're voting for something called electors. This is the kind of stuff that we all learned in probably in somewhere in civics class, somewhere along the line in middle school. What happens when you cast a vote is there's a presidential name on the ballot, but you're actually voting for the people who the party has designated as supporters of that candidate. And there's an elaborate process that results in those electors eventually going to something called the Electoral College, which only exists in the ethosphere. It's not an actual place. And you need 270 electors to elect a president. The key to it is that what happens is sort of what happens with the process. And you know, stop me if I'm putting you to sleep or telling you stuff you already know. But the way it works is in each county, there is a local election board. And the local election board meets after the votes are counted and basically says, yep, that's right. Those are the votes. Those are the votes that count. And then based upon those votes, they award the winning candidates electors for that county. But they have to certify the result, and this is the key. There are over 100 election deniers, that is, people who have claimed and continue to claim that Trump actually won the 2020 election. And there are 100 of them sitting on local county election boards across the United States. And the reason that's significant is because the county election board is the one that has to certify, the body that has to certify voting results for that county so the electors get awarded. Every county in the state has to then certify its results so that the state can certify its total result and award electoral votes based upon the total result of all the certified counties. It only takes one county to screw up the whole deal. So if one county in a state refuses to certify its results, none of the electors in that state can be appointed because the state can't certify its results. And I should have said this earlier, the 102 election deniers, those are only the people in the from the swing states that are going to decide the election. After the state certifies, then it goes to the Secretary of State. And then the Secretary of State sends it to the governor. And then the list of electors who are selected then go to Washington, D.C., where in the National Archives, where they're then counted on, get ready, January 6th. Now you know the significance of January 6th. You also know why Trump was frantically making phone calls first to local election board officials in swing states in 2020. That didn't work. And then he went to the Secretary of State, most famously Georgia, trying to get them to either give him the votes that he needed or pretend that he got the votes that he needed. That didn't work. And that's why he tried to twist the arms and twisted the arms of Brian Kemp in Georgia. And Arizona's governor at the time, both of whom said no, or you know, basically refused to do Trump's bidding. He went right up the chain from the local accounting board to the governor of the state. Doug Ducey was Arizona, trying to get them to essentially bollocks up the works. And the reason I'm worried about that is I think that's the issue that has gotten insufficient attention, because here's the way that's going to work. If Trump wins the election, obviously none of the shenanigans is going to happen. But if he loses, the danger that you have is that you get to November 7th, everybody says, we made it, the election's over, the voting's over, now all we have to do is see who won and inaugurate him or her on January 20th. The difficulty is, if Trump throws the kind of monkey wrenches into the machine that his MAGA people are capable of throwing into the machine, at the local county level, you could have chaos. You could have a situation between Election Day and Inauguration Day where some states are basically unable to certify their results because a local county board has refused to do so because a MAGA denier or enough MAGA deniers on the board have said, you know, we're not going to certify this. And then you have, well, frankly, you have a prescription for not just chaos, but even violence and a civil insurrection, war kind of problem.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's somewhere around December 11th that the states will then certify before sending it on for ratification in Washington on January 6th. So we may see trouble as early as the second week of December.
Yep, that's right. They missed the deadline. You know, there are different sort of special exceptions that allow some relief from the deadline. But, you know, for Trump, if he loses the election, the name of the game for him will be to delay acceptance or certification of that loss, if you will, so that during the interregnum he can create chaos, which is, frankly, as we all know, that's his specialty. Frankly, it's a frightening proposition. But even worse, in some ways, is that there are examples of where it's happened, not in a presidential setting, but just to give you an example, in 2022, the Republican-led commission in New Mexico, Otero County, New Mexico, refused to certify primary election results because Trump's endorsed candidate didn't win. One of the commission members was the co-founder of Cowboys for Trump. Now, the check there, you say, well, that's the courts will come in, they'll fix this. And the answer to that is, well, maybe. In the New Mexico case, a Democrat was the Secretary of State, and he sued to force the board to certify the vote totals. And the judge who got the case was apparently an even-handed, apply-the-law type judge. But just imagine if you were in a state where the Attorney General was a MAGA election denier, and where the court that ultimately had to decide the issue was as out to lunch as this Eileen Cannon in Florida is, who dismissed Trump's documents case. She's going to get reversed for sure, but it didn't stop her from reversing the case. And you've got disaster, because how are you going to speed that process up? Pretty tough.
I'm certainly not a constitutional law scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but my understanding is that in the Constitution, our Electoral College is set up where the electors were originally slated to be picked by the legislatures of their respective states. Only later was it modified to where the person that won the vote in the state would then be awarded the electors. So it seems that there's still a tremendous amount of power in the hands of a state legislature, which in 2020, when there was this fake electors, real electors battle going on, I mean, that's the kind of thing you would not want to see go find its way to the Supreme Court, because they may just say the state legislatures could do whatever they want. And we've discussed this before. I think there was some issues of this in the past.
The law requires the legislature to determine how it's going to select the electors before the election occurs, so that at least theoretically, the situation where the legislature could essentially take over the function that currently is performed by the popular vote, theoretically that can't happen unless they decide to do it before the election occurs. But your fundamental point is correct. Take the case, you know, today, yesterday, a Fulton County judge ruled that the local election boards do not have any discretion to refuse to certify a result. That was a case in Fulton County, Georgia, where the question was, can they ask for investigations and so forth pursuant to some of the new legislation that or the new rules that the board has adopted there. And that court, one court, Fulton County judge, said, no, you can't do that. The election board in Fulton County can't decide on its own that it's going to refuse to certify because it wants to investigate further. The problem is, what happens if, for example, on appeal, it goes to a group of judges that are sympathetic to Trump? What if you're in a, you ultimately get to the U.S. Supreme Court, where, as you say, they love to say things, not necessarily with any consistency, but they love to make the argument that, well, you know, this is really up to the states. And, you know, whether you're talking about pro-choice and abortion and or something like election rules for governing elections.
Right.
And there are supposed to be federal rules that apply to federal elections. You can easily envision this Supreme Court, dominated by conservatives, three of whom Trump picked, saying, you know what, I don't think we want to get involved in this. I think that it's a mistake to second guess whatever the local states are doing. And if that's what they want to do, then, you know, that's what they're going to do. And they get to investigate. They do whatever they want. Never mind that it turns democracy upside down and on its head and risks a kind of, as I say, uncontrolled chaos that would result between an election and the inauguration.
I would agree. We are facing the upending of the American democracy. And as you pointed in your article, the courts could be just one huge battleground in this. And I guess the question I have is, with this many weeks before the election, is there any way the populace can put extra pressure on the courts to do what they should?
On this precise issue, the analysis that was done was by the Center for Media and Democracy. And they've listed all of the people who are the election deniers that they identified as people who basically take the position that Trump won the election in 2020, who are sitting on local election board. There are also another 150 election deniers who are politicians in significant positions of power, whether they're state attorneys general or, you know, even in some cases, governors or J.D. Vance, potential vice president. Maybe there are other things you could do, but the only thing I can think of that's effective is, well, two things. One, and I think the Democrats are to some degree getting ready for this sort of thing, make sure you have a veritable army of lawyers ready to jump in on a moment's notice and move quickly to get the thing fixed quickly. The second thing you can do, and I think you could do it just starting immediately, is shine a media spotlight on every one of these people by name. You know, put them in a position where they understand they're under a real microscope here. Now, I'm not sure they care, but at the same time, there has to be some kind of pressure that would come from sunlight as the best disinfectant. And just exposing who these people are, the positions that they have, and making them much more stuck in the media spotlight than they ever wanted to be has to help. You know, there were instances where in Michigan, for example, in 2020, Trump thought he had persuaded a couple of, and he maybe well have persuaded a couple of local election board officials in one county, Detroit, I think it was, to hold back on their certification. And the public pressure that was brought to bear was sufficient for those people to get wobbly and ultimately certify the result. So that kind of pressure can work.
Well, we'd be happy to read the names of all of these suspect electoral officials on this program. But the question is, will the mainstream media, and this is a big question, will the mainstream media direct its attention to this? Because from what I've seen in the last month, and in the last month, Harris's apparent lead seems to be dwindling. As Trump has appeared more and more demented and more out to lunch on stage, the mainstream media continues to sane-wash him. They don't cover his behavior as they should, as bizarre as it is.
Yep, there was a great example of that in Trump's recent what's the word for it? You know, when he danced to music for 30 minutes.
He's the new Dick Clark.
and the way that it was covered by the media was, it was along the lines of, well, there were, after two medical emergencies, Trump went to a change of pace and decided everyone should listen to music.
They're totally covering for him on this.
Yes, and the right way to write that story would have been to say, you know, long after the medical emergencies had been cleared, Trump, in one of his most bizarre episodes yet, said, I'm not going to take any more questions. This is a moderated Q&A.
Right.
And he says, I'm not going to take any more questions. Let's just listen to music and dance.
Right. It's hard to find anything that would surprise us about Trump at this point, but that's just turning another corner.
Yeah.
I have to ask you about the bombshell revelations that came out of U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, and what Jack Smith is doing is to point out just how guilty Trump was regarding January 6th. And there was talk about that phrase, bombshell revelations, but the mainstream media just doesn't seem to be that interested in this.
Nope, and that should be the story of the century. That should be one of the most important stories in American history since the Civil War.
Yes.
You can't even find it now. I mean, it made a splash for, what, 24 hours?
Right.
MSNBC covered it, and it was like, oh, yeah, well, look at this. You know, here's another one. Trump just blows it off. Now he's hiding. You can see why he doesn't want to do any serious Q&A from any serious journalist.
He can't finish sentences.
No. It's really something. And the way that the media was climbing all over President Biden's frame, you expect something close to comparable treatment with Trump, who's far more bizarre in his behavior than anything that Biden did during the debate. You know, you can accuse Biden of losing his train of thought a couple of times. You can accuse him of appearing to be, you know, not as strong as he often appears to be, and so forth. And I think Harris, frankly, is probably doing better than Biden would have done, no matter what happens in the election. It's probably better than Biden would have done. But the complete past that the media is giving Trump, it's just proof that the media has never learned. It learned none of the lessons of 2016. It's learned none of the lessons of the Trump administration. It does not know how to cover Donald Trump, and he knows that.
But at the same time, one could say that the studies showed that the mass media of the United States in 2016 profited handsomely from the Trump campaign, because people were entertained and interested and would pay attention to it, putting more eyes on the screen, more ears listening, and therefore more money in the pockets of the corporations.
Right. And that is a reflection of the broader problem in society. I sort of shook my head in disbelief when I heard that this was over 10 years ago, when Northwestern had renamed some of its programs from journalism to news marketing.
Oh, God!
It kind of tells you all, right? Tells you everything, doesn't it? I mean, that is the problem. And if everything is geared towards, you know, marketing, clicks, short-term profits, you name it, you know, you can't find a newsroom. You know, Walter Cronkite would be wandering around in an empty room if he were, you know, doing the news now. Newspapers don't have, for the most part, with some exceptions, notably, but they don't have anywhere near the kind of real news capability that they had 20 or 30 years ago. And that's because there's no money in it. There's no money in the news. It's not a profit center.
Well, Silicon Valley's making money hand over fist, and basically I think that younger people in particular just set up their own bubble around themselves and get the news that they expect. And that is totally dividing the country, because people keep reinforcing their beliefs, whether they're liberal or conservative or whatever.
Yep. Everybody finds their own comfortable echo chamber. And guess what? All these people agree with me, so I must be right. Then, you know, that's become kind of the dominant attitude. I don't even know how you begin to fix it. I honestly don't.
Well, with 2 weeks before the election, I guess as we close off today, I would ask, what is there something you'd recommend that our listeners could do in a practical sense in the time we have left to try and edge things toward Harris?
Vote. Okay. It's the most important thing you can do. Contributions, do those help? Sure. But I think we're, personally, this is just my opinion, I think we've entered the, we probably have been there for a while, but I think we've entered the phase where money isn't going to make very much difference to what people decide to do or not do in terms of voting. If you know anybody who's on the fence, explain the stakes, help them understand what's at issue here.
Right.
I really think the biggest problem is that people do not have a good sense of the magnitude of what can happen here. Everybody says, well, you know, this is the most important election in my lifetime. You hear that every time there's an election. This is it. This is a ball game, and we're at a real inflection point for the entire country. You just have to take it really seriously. And I understand, you know, people have their daily lives to worry about. They have their things they're trying to do. Just try to, for a day, for a single day, just try to focus on what it is that's happening in the country, what it is that is going to happen depending upon who wins this election, and then decide what you want your country to look like for your children and grandchildren, because believe me, that you're making that decision on November 7th.
Well, hopefully those galvanized listeners will refer people they're trying to lobby into listening to our conversation on this program, so we can hope for the best.
That's right. Prepare for the worst and hope for the best. That's all you can do.
Well, we'll have one more show before the election on next week. We'd like you to come back for at least a little bit and just see how things are shaping up.
Okay, we'll all take our anti-anxiety medication. And
yeah, a little Ativan wouldn't hurt.
There you go. Maybe in an IV.
All right. Well, always a pleasure, Stephen J. Harper. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk again soon.
Indeed. Thanks a lot, Doug.
Returning to the program at this point is lawyer and activist Nancy Yamada, making, I think, her, third or fourth appearance on the program, something like that. And my understanding is she's not only a lawyer and activist, but she's also a pretty fair tennis player. Well, welcome back to Radio Parallax, Nancy.
Okay. One correction is retired attorney and been on injured reserve, so no tennis lately. But thank you for having me.
Well, we appreciate your activism, which we've talked about in the past. And these days, you're involved in the efforts, as a lot of us are, to, I guess you'd say, get the vote out and do what we can on election day. So tell us about that.
Let me first ask you, Doug, have you voted yet?
In fact, I have.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. Can you do me a favor and get three other people you know to ensure that they've also voted or are planning to vote?
Well, that's the whole point of a radio show. We're urging a lot of people to go out there and do exactly that. I wish we had more definite connections to the swing states, but who knows? Maybe we can reach out to Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin.
I'm glad that you have this radio show to encourage people to get out and vote, but the personal touch does work. And so I am asking you to actually get your phone out or knock on a couple of doors of people that you personally know and encourage them to vote.
All right. I shall do so.
And Edward, have you voted yet?
No.
Are you planning to vote?
This election? Probably.
This one in particular.
He just found out there's an election coming.
No one told me. I didn't get the mail.
Yes, I'm sure we can count on his getting out there and casting a ballot.
Okay. Well, what I would like each of you to do is ask three other people to make sure that they are voting. And if they haven't voted already, ask them what their plan to vote is. I mean, I think when people visualize it, it encourages them to go out and vote.
Yes, indeed. And being that we all live in California and will thus, I'm sure, if we're talking to friends and neighbors close at hand, it'll be a California turnout. But That doesn't elect the president. It's not a popular vote thing, but nevertheless, the more votes we generate, the more people are supporting Harris, the better it looks.
Absolutely, but I wouldn't ignore California or New York. I mean, of course, they're strongly blue, and probably will be electing Harris. But we also have to win the House of Representatives and the Senate and our state legislatures.
That's true.
I think it was maybe a week ago or so, maybe 2 weeks ago, I read or heard, and I did check out the statistics, that the House of Representatives, there are many swing states in Central California and as in parts of New York, which could actually control the House of Representatives.
That's true.
So that would be very important as they are seated and sworn in and will be the ones that will be certifying the presidential election.
Yes, they will. Although people who are elected, I think on the certification process, you have to already be in office, no?
No, but they get sworn in before
Oh, that's right. I stand corrected. That's right. They do get sworn in before the whole January 6th extravaganza.
Right. So whether you're in California or New York or other blue state, make sure you vote the down ballot.
Okay. Advice taken.
The other thing I would say, ignore the polls. They're saying they're neck and neck, that sometimes Harris is up. Just ignore the polls. Remember what happened in 2016?
All too well.
This time Hillary was, I think, had 91%. And so just ignore the polls. What matters is getting people out to vote. That is going to make all the difference.
And I think a point that needs to be made here that we made in a show a couple of weeks ago, which Lawrence O'Donnell's talking about again on MSNBC, is that a lot of people, they are not enamored with either party right now, and some feel they ought to just go ahead and vote for a third party. But he makes the point over and over again that a vote for Jill Stein is a vote for Donald Trump. That needs to be stressed, I think.
Yes, I mean, I understand people who want to vote for Jill Stein. But we really need to get Trump defeated.
Yeah, first things first, yes.
Yes, first things first. So it's just very important to get the vote out. That's going to make the difference. And I don't know if, you know, when I talk to people, when I see people, when you see them on social media, people are either freaking out if they care about this country and economic and social justice and civil rights. They're either freaking out or wringing their hands. And you know what? Hopes and prayers are not going to win this election. We really need to get the vote out.
Yeah, Ms. McMillan points out that some of the polling data is based on people who have voted previously, and there are undoubtedly a large number of people who are going to be casting their ballots for the first time or just hadn't voted before who are going to affect the outcome. And that's not being reflected necessarily in polling.
Right. We have to get out the vote. So there's two ways to go about it at this point. And one is to canvass, which is another term for knocking on doors. And the other one is phone banking. And that's phone banking from either a physical location set up somewhere or via your computer. And I would point people to certain organizations. One that I like is indivisible.org.
Okay.
There's different chapters. There's a Sacramento chapter. And it tells you if you go to, I forget what it is, indivisiblesacramento, I think, .org. But if you go to indivisible.org, you can punch in your zip code, and they will take you to local actions. But it's not only local actions. Like this morning, in preparation for this, I was just looking at Sacramento. And they not only had local Sacramento actions, but they had, organized canvassing in Central California, where they would do carpools and buses, and also to the, working on the Harris campaign in Nevada. So, and that included like overnight stays that would be paid for and things like that. And I think there are a lot of people who live near swing states, if not in swing states, that could utilize these resources. And the other thing is the Democratic Party. I am a registered Democrat, but I'm not a gung-ho Democrat. But this is important, and I'm sure that they will have canvassing, phone banking opportunities.
And when it all comes right down to it with the Electoral College, It's really the people in those seven or eight states that are going to swing this thing. If Harris takes Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which Clinton failed to do in 2016, she wins. She's president. So, I mean, and if she fails on, say, Pennsylvania, she can pick it up by Nevada and North Carolina or Georgia. There's lots of ways to do this. But it really does come down to, you know, people in a few states having an undue amount of power in this, you know, in saying who's going to be the next president.
When you think about it and how many thousands of votes or 10,000 votes, and just think about how many few votes that is in each precinct in that state. So every vote really does matter, and especially in those swing states. I mean, I've been working, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Nevada, and Arizona.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
And like I said, it's very late in the game. It's 2 weeks out now when we're recording, and less than that by the time this airs. So I'm going to ask everybody to check into Indivisible.org, their Democratic Party, and another one is BVM, Black Voters Matter. They work a lot out of Texas and Georgia in getting out the vote.
All right. Well, Nancy Yamada, thanks for the insights. Maybe we can have you come back after the election. We could do a postmortem on all of this.
I hope we'll be celebrating and drunk it for a good reason.
Oh, God, I hope so. In case anybody's forgotten, 24 years ago, George W. Bush became president with a 537-vote majority in the state of Florida. We shouldn't forget that.
No, we should not. Your vote matters, people.
Yes, it does. Nancy, always a pleasure. We'll talk soon, I hope.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. I'm not sure what we're going to do, Mr. McMillan, for the election show. We schedule our programs to go out on Wednesday morning. That will be the morning after the election. I anticipate that the election will not be decided the next morning. I hope I'm wrong. I hope it's a landslide for Kamala Harris, but I don't think we're going to be that lucky. As you will recall, a scant 4 years ago in Biden versus Trump, we did not know for sure that it was going to go to Biden for several days as the vote counts in Arizona and Georgia came through. One thing's for sure, it's going to be a Donnybrook. The Republicans are planning all kinds of legal challenges. I hope the Democrats are planning all sorts of counter challenges to what are going to be coup d'etat efforts. There's really no other way to put it. Anyway, it's going to be mighty interesting. You've been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett.